The Mike Lupica Podcast.
New York Daily News columnist and best-selling author.
Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A billion-dollar industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Before we chat with a woman I think is the best tennis broadcaster on the planet and just one of the best broadcasters, period, man or woman on the planet, Mary Carrillo, I want to let you know that today's show, as usual, is brought to you by Geico. When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money. This is the Mike Lupica Podcast with someone who I have known far too long. In fact, I've reached the point where I think it's enough. She is one of the most talented communicators and broadcasters on television. I used to tell people she's the best female broadcaster on television, but it's far too limiting and actually kind of half insulting. Mary Carrillo, you have seen her work on the Olympics. It's fantastic. She worked for years at ESPN on tennis. She's now with the Tennis Channel. She does fine reporting and writing for Real Sports, and she has done some amazing documentary work. I could list them all. She did one on the 60 U.S. Open in golf with hardly any footage. She did one on the rivalry between Borg and McEnroe. I think it was called Fire and Ice, that I thought was almost perfect, except I thought in the end it was a little heavy on Borg and McEnroe and a little light on me.
Not enough,
but I mean, that's
Lupica?
That's a small quibble, but I wanted to call her today because all of a sudden the beauty of sports is that out of nowhere, out of the sky, everything can happen. She is in Melbourne covering the Australian Open for Tennis Channel, and everything has happened. Hey, Mayor.
Hello, Michael. It's a very nice place to be, Australia. Very nice. Especially with all the cockamamie stuff going on in American politics. This tournament is holding my universe together, Michael.
Mayor, if I had... just yeah, imagine...
Is that too much?
Mayor, imagine now, just imagine that you're like a big time fancy pants movie producer. And I come to you and I said, I've got a movie for the 2017 Australian Open. Tell me what you think. See if you can buy this. And I tell you that we get Federer and Nadal one more time, and we get the Williams sisters not just playing in Australia where they first played, I think like 19 years ago, but playing one more Grand Slam final when one is 35, 36. That's my pitch. You're the big fancy pants movie executive, and you would say,
are you nuts? That's right. This is Welcome to Jurassic Park, Michael. That is what Melbourne Park has become, Rod Laver Arena. And guess what? Australia, these people are so tennis mad. They're so tennis crazy. They deserve what has happened during this fortnight. It's fabulous. It's affirming. It's life affirming. these are four of the all-time great tennis players that are still around. Well, as we're speaking right now, Rafa Nadal hasn't gotten past Grigor Dimitrov. But if it's Nadal and Federer in the final, I'll watch that. If it's Dimitrov and Federer, I'll watch that. The idea that Serena Williams, in order to break Steffi Graf's tie at 22 majors, she's got to go through her older sister, her very best friend. I mean, the true love of her life. Yeah, that's a lot of storylines to try to cram into one movie.
Mayor, I wrote about this the other day, and it's quite amazing because, you know, we have seen over our time in tennis. I met Mary at Wimbledon in the 70s. She was precocious. I think she played her first match there at the age of 8. I was much older.
Yeah,
Mayor,
sure.
But it has become a governance of the young, okay? And suddenly, out of the sky, we get a major championship, the first major championship of the year, and 6 of the 8 semifinalists are over the age of 30. We got a 36-year-old, 2 35-year-olds, a 34-year-old, and Lucia Baroni would have been a story for the ages on her own, and Stan Wawrinka and Rafa Nadal and all of a sudden, old guys and old girls rule.
Yeah, it's just been tremendous because really the narrative that had settled around Roger and Rafa, both of whom were injured and missed, you know, Roger missed the last half a year in 2016. Rafa skipped the last 4 months. Serena Williams didn't play again after she lost in the semis of the U.S. Open. Venus Williams has been struggling with health issues since 2011, you know. So the narrative had been, all right, well, they're, you know, they might not ever win another one, or if they're lucky, Serena might get a couple more. But now we've got a real amazing and life-affirming story or two at this tournament. It's been wonderful. By the way, it's not like they're just showing glimpses of greats. Serena is playing this week better than I've seen her play in a couple of years. Even when she won Wimbledon last year, I don't think she played as well as she's playing right now, right this second. Venus hasn't played this well for a long while. Even though she had a soft draw, she still had to get through it in the Australian summertime heat. Rafa hasn't looked this good in a couple of years. The focus and intensity he's showing, I haven't seen in a long while. And Roger, I mean, this is stuff from out of the files, Michael. I mean, the stuff he's cooking up it's kind of breathtaking.
Mary, by the way, this might sound slightly off point and off subject to you, but has the Australian Open matched the excitement of doing the cat thing and because
Michael,
isn't
that's the thing. Okay, so you're taking a little shot at me, aren't you?
No.
All right, go ahead. I'm just saying it has gotten, you know, we have both covered sports for so long and we both clearly have outside interests. I have covered the Westminster Dog Show, the National Dog Show. I've covered the last couple of Kitten Bowls for Hallmark Channel. I love them because, yeah. I mean, animals are so playful and they can, you know, and they're so cute and adorable. And sometimes in this world of ours, I need to be able to smile. But it is very nice for me when human beings actually step up and play glorious, luminous tennis. And that's what's been happening in these couple of weeks down here.
Okay, let's start with Federer because, you know, you referred to him as the happy warrior because there's this idea, and it all flows through this notion in America now that if you don't get a championship ring, if you're not playing in the finals, if you're not in the Super Bowl, the World Series, you're dirt, okay? And here's this guy
yes.
who's won 17 major championships, has played a level of tennis that we probably will never see again, a beautiful game of tennis. And so he's not winning majors, except he still loves being Roger Federer, and he still loves
That's right.
being in the middle of the action.
Yes. No. He has, look, that guy, I've never seen anyone bend time the way Roger Federer has. I'm not just referring to his age. The way he conducts his tennis on the court, the way he lives his life off the court, he never seems rushed, Michael. He'll have to give a press conference in three different languages. He's answered the same question 4 billion times, and he still acts like it's a fresh question, that it's actually a good question. I've never seen anybody walk through life as a champion, you know, and with so many demands on and walk so lightly as Roger. And then you have Rafa, who's a very different kind of cat. And Rafa uses the word, when he talks about his tennis, he uses the word suffer a lot. He says, I know I must suffer. Roger Federer never uses those kind of words, Michael, but
right.
he, and that's what makes them such an interesting pairing. And let's face it, if we do get that final, you know, you and I, we've talked about this a lot. You know, if Rafa wins, he gets to 15
yep.
major titles with
yep.
the French Open yawning ahead.
Yep.
And then he's very close to Roger 17. So many people have already ordained that Roger's the greatest of all time, but hasn't been the greatest of his own time when he has to face Rafa Nadal. He's lost 2/3 of his matches against the Spaniard. So then what do you do? And clearly, we got to wait till the whole thing's over, don't we, before we have this barroom discussion. But that is the glory, the beauty of the rivalry between these two. Stylistically, you know, the matchup is bad for Roger Federer. But if that's the 2017 Australian Championship, if those two guys are going to decide it, that's just one of the all-time great stories.
You know,
and the women's side is the same thing. Venus and Serena.
I mean, no, it's off the hook. You really? Can't. It's a preposterous narrative. It's a preposterous narrative
it
that
is.
You guys are writing. Let me go back to Federer for a minute, because the way you described him, Mary, is the way we describe Jack Nicklaus for years and years. And it's interesting that if he does win this Australian Open, he gets to 18. That's the magic number in golf. And Jack had the same sort of family life that Roger has. And Jack not only won 18 majors, he finished second 19 times. And I think it was Dan Jenkins who said Jack lost as well as he won. And Federer's the same way. Mm. Okay. He loses. And by the way, it's not pejorative. We're not calling him a loser. What I'm saying is he finishes second as well as he finishes first with a level of grace that has become more and more uncommon in sports. Don't you think?
Yes. He is uncommonly graceful and gracious, Roger. And he's also, Michael, so damn emotional. And this guy cries a lot, you know, like it clearly means so very much to him to be a part of history. When he talked like yesterday after he won against Stan Wawrinka in five tough sets after winning the first two, he was talking in the press and someone mentioned, you know, Laver and Emerson and Rosewall. And he just went on this rhapsodic, you know, speech about just being in the same conversation with those guys and how much it means to him. I mean, Roger is an historian and he loves being a part of all of this. But, Jack Nicklaus, years ago, when Tiger was still playing great and Roger was losing quite a bit to Rafa, Jack Nicklaus was in the Royal Box at Wimbledon. And I was working with Ted Robinson and John McEnroe. We showed a shot of Nicklaus. And I said to the guys, I said, all right, so he's got 18 majors. I said, who gets to 18 first, Tiger Woods or Roger Federer or neither? And neither Roger nor Tiger has gotten to Jack's 18 major titles yet. And I'm still wondering if maybe, just maybe, Roger can do it here.
And we're talking to Mary
Quillo. And he took a big gamble. Michael, he took a big gamble, by the way. When Roger shut it down, he got to the semis of Wimbledon, lost a round, it shut down the rest of his year.
Yeah.
Because he knew he wasn't quite healthy. You know, he'd had knee surgery, and he's had a kind of a wonky back for the last couple of years. For him to decide to shut down, to skip the U.S. Open, to skip the fall, that was a risky thing. And look what it's given him. Look how fresh and joyful he looks out there now.
You know, it's funny, Mayor. I was thinking this watching him. Every time he would come up short in a major over the past couple of years, I would think to myself, okay, that's his last best chance. Or when he loses to Djokovic at the Open, okay, that's his last best chance. This has to be his last. You know, I know a lot about tennis. I'm a smart guy. Clearly, yep. This is his last best chance, except now here he comes and you know, we thought things had broken right for him at Wimbledon when Djokovic lost to Sam Querrey, but all of a sudden things fall into place. But even then I'm looking at Stan the Man in the semis. And Mary, you know, I was at the final at the U.S. Open last year, and I'm watching the match with a couple of my sons and my wife, and about halfway through that match I said, you know, if you didn't know anything about anything, who would you think is the number one player in the world right now? You'd think it was Wawrinka, the way he was playing, okay?
Yeah.
And so he's a tough out. He's a tough out. And when it went five sets, tell me what you're thinking when the match goes to the fifth set on Thursday night in Australia.
Well, clearly Wawrinka had taken a medical timeout. And when he came back, you know, he had his knee worked on, and all of a sudden he's got more energy. He's moving better. He's hitting harder. It looked like, and then Roger, who's not, you can't often accuse Roger of gamesmanship, but then he took a timeout as well. And you know, towards the back end of this match, and he admitted afterwards that it was more mental than physical. You know, he had to kind of reset because obviously Wawrinka was coming at him again. But I guess I always figured that I thought that Roger had to win it in four sets. Otherwise, he could lose it in five. That's kind of how I feel about Roger these days. I feel the same way if he's to play Rafa. If he's better shut him down. You know, he better not take it the distance. He better do it, you know, quickly. Come out of the blocks really strong and really boldly. Otherwise, you know, Rafa's going to grind you down. It was beautiful. I loved it. Wasn't an all-time great match, that match with Wawrinka and Federer, but it's creating an absolutely and by the way, I mean, look, Roger's loved everywhere, but here in Australia, I mean, this is a guy who has shown such great knowledge and respect for the great Aussies of the past. They adore him here, Michael. And he feels it, and he feeds off of it. And it's like that. And again, Venus is kind of doing the same thing as Roger is. I mean, I certainly didn't expect Venus Williams to still be in the hunt anywhere but at Wimbledon. I mean, I still take her very seriously. She's won Wimbledon five times. You give her a good draw and a court with speed in it, she's going to still be there. But it goes back to that old what Longfellow's, you know, we judge ourselves by what we feel capable of doing, and others judge us by what we've already done. I mean, I honestly thought that Venus wasn't going to have a shot, and I frankly thought that Roger's best chance, you know, they're few and far between. But now we got a situation here, a real situation. It's fabulous.
Mary Carrillo is my guest on the Mike Lubega podcast. She is one of the best broadcasters and communicators and writers on the planet. One more question about Roger, because Mary once famously said, how can you be the greatest player of all time when there's a player you can't beat in your time, meaning Nadal?
Yeah.
It was interesting to me on the court, I'll say this morning for me, last night for you, to hear Roger talking to Jim Courier about his rivalry with Nadal. And it was almost like a rim shot where he talked about all the matches he lost to him early on clay. And he didn't say it in a defensive way, but clearly that record, Mary, what is it, like 23-11? Is that what it is? I may be.
Yeah. It's overwhelmingly in Rafa's favor, and a large measure of them have happened on red clay. Yeah. And again, it's a matchup deal. Stylistically, it's just bad for, you know, Rafa revolutionized tennis with his forehand, and that especially a huge high kicking lefty forehand to Roger Federer's one handed backhand. I mean, that's a matchup that you can't get away from that. You know, that is a very hard thing to solve. And Rafa, because he's got such tremendous defensive skills, he can chase down Federer winners that very few people can. So for Roger to have to hit three or four winners in one point, you know, just to gain some kind of an edge over the Spaniard, that's a hard thing for him to do. So again, tennis is so much about matchups, so much about matchups. My feeling is Grigor Dimitrov, who plays like,
You know, it's like boxing, okay? You know, Frazier could beat Ali, and Ali could beat Foreman, and Foreman beat the crap out of Frazier. You're absolutely right. Matchups are everything in a sport that is boxing without the physical contact. And you, obviously, you grew up playing the sport. You were mentored by the great Harry Hopman. And can I ask you a technical question?
Oh boy! All right, let's. It's not about your own game, is it, Michael?
No,
you're not still working on your serve.
Well, I am, but that's another story for another day. But here's the thing: what took Rafa so long to get closer to the baseline on the other guy's serve?
Well,
I don't want to sound worked up about it, but what the hell took him so long?
You sound a little worked up about it. You know, Rafa. Obviously, clay court players tend to play beyond the baseline, you know, in back of the baseline a lot more than hard court players. Rafa's got return grips. You know, he's got extreme grips. So sometimes you'll see Rafa, you know, have to sort of chop something back on his forehand side because he's prepared with his backhand grips. So sometimes you see a lot of those kind of returns from Rafa Nadal, and it's really a function of his grips that he'll have to chip something back instead of give it a big roundhouse swing. But then once you give him, that's why he's so good on clay. Clay gives you time. It gives him time for his very elaborate, generous takebacks you know, his big swings. You need a little bit of time to set up for that. And that's what makes him so dangerous and so difficult on clay. But I think he's a very smart guy. He makes an awful lot of adjustments in the course of a match. And, of course, his Uncle Tony is often, you know, yelling at him, coaching him, which is illegal. But, you know, he's often telling him, you know, what he should be doing too. And clearly he can hear his uncle's voice even in a crowd of 20,000. He's a tremendous fighter. He's a terrific, you know, and he's smart. He knows what he's got to do to make his game effective.
We're talking to Mary Carrillo. Okay, if who has surprised you more over these 2 weeks, whether they play in the finals or not? Has it been more of a surprise to see Rafa do this, or has it been more of a surprise to see Roger do this?
Well, first, the big surprise is, let's face it, Novak Djokovic lost.
Right. Right.
That was a big surprise. Andy Murray, the number one player in the world now, they lost. So,
right.
I mean, my big surprise is there are all these holes being poked in the draw in the first week of this tournament. So those were big surprises. I have to say that Rafa is the bigger surprise to me because he hasn't looked this good in a couple of years, Michael. He looks so much physically, he's much stronger, much bigger than he's looked in a long while. He's got much more confidence in his game, much more. You can tell that he really has belief in his forehand again, which is the absolute key to the rest of his game. His forehand, and when he's cracking his forehand and just really leaning on it and throwing it down, I mean, that's a sign that he's feeling pretty good about himself. So I would say that Rafa's form to me has surprised me more than Roger's. Roger always makes it. He can be streaky now at this stage of his career, but he always looks good, doesn't he? He always looks gorgeous. He looks beautiful. He looks luminous. He looks, you know, elegant, and he makes it all look easy. When Rafa is not playing well, he would say, he suffers, you know?
Right.
Rafa's the bigger surprise to me.
It's the old Pat Riley line. There's winning and there's misery. Okay, you can tell I'm a little fixed on Federer, but we've got other matters to discuss here. I've got a lot of things to get to. But
what do you want to know? There's a lot going on here, Michael.
In the final, whether it's against Dimitrov or whether it's against Rafa, I tended to think it'll be against Rafa, but you know what? After this Australian Open, I'm not putting any money down on anything.
Exactly.
What would, if something let Roger down in the final, would it be, you know, I've said to you before that I think that as beautiful as his forehand still is, that sometimes he misses forehands in big moments the way aging golfers miss short putts. But what do you think would let him down in the final?
This has been true of Roger Federer for years now. His conversion of break points is the one glaring problem in his game. And especially if it's against the lefty serve of Rafa, I mean, that to me is the, you know, he has chances. He'll have his looks to break serve, and then they go begging. That to me will always be, if there are opportunities lost for Roger Federer to win a big match, it tends to be on the fact that he can't convert break points. That's a big one, and especially against Rafa. Look, if Rafa plays Grigor Dimitrov, Grigor plays a lot like Roger. He was called Baby Fed for a long time.
Right, right.
So Rafa will have, if Rafa beats Grigor, he'll have a good warm-up for Roger, won't he?
Right.
So my feeling is if Grigor Dimitrov beats Rafa Nadal, if Dimitrov beats Rafa, then Roger wins the Australian Open. But if Rafa beats Grigor, I got to give the edge to Rafa to win his 15th title. That would be my guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've made a lot of bad guesses at this tournament alone.
So am I. We're talking more with Mary Carrillo after this from Barracuda.
If you're familiar with cloud computing, you probably know that Amazon Web Services offers a complete set of secure compute, storage, application, and deployment services that help companies launch and scale their IT infrastructures while lowering costs. But did you know that you're still responsible for protecting your own AWS-based assets, meaning your applications and data, from advanced cyber threats? Protect your AWS with Barracuda Network's advanced firewall solutions. Visit AWS Marketplace or barracuda.com/AWS to learn more.
We're talking to Mary Carrillo, who was nice enough to join us on a work day from Melbourne. She's struggling with, actually, even as we're having this conversation, with what time it actually is in Melbourne. Connors once said to me, I was talking to Zach Lupica, my youngest boy, today about this, because he wanted to know what time I woke up today. And I said, I woke up at 5:30. So I saw pretty much the last two sets. And I'm talking to Connors one day about Nadal, and it was a throwaway line. In fact, if I'd known it was going to have this kind of traction, I just would have stolen it for myself. And he said, the guy plays like he's broke. And he is back to
Michael,
doing
that's one of my all-time favorite quotes.
It was, Mary, it was like a throwaway line. A guy plays like he's broke. And I'm thinking, oh my God. I said to him at the time, I said, that's the greatest description I've ever heard of his game. Because we can all say, oh, he plays every point like it's match point. No, he plays like he's broke. It's the old Lee Trevino thing. The pressure is playing for $5 when you've got two in your pocket. That was the great Trevino definition. But when you look at Rafa now, you can try all you want, but if you're not healthy and you're not on top of your game, it doesn't mean a damn. And do you think has his serve come back to being something close to what it was when he could win Wimbledon's off of Roger Federer?
I think he's been taking pretty good care of his serve. Absolutely. At this tournament, yes. He's under the gun on his serve a lot. It's not, he's not an ace meister. The first time he won the U.S. Open, Michael, I know you'll remember, he was serving in the 130s. And he only really did that for those couple of weeks. And then now he's back to, using the leftiness of his serve more than the speed. But no, Rafa, I cannot tell you how impressed I've been with his body language is back.
Right.
And that's
right.
been missing
right.
for a long while. His swagger is back. His fist pumps, he seems to truly believe in the moment the way that's been missing for a long while now. And that to me is, and that means that he will go for a big serve if he's down break point. He'll go for a better second serve. I cannot tell you how impressed I've been with the form of Rafa. I haven't seen him like this, as I said, in a couple of years.
When, it's funny, and again, you once described McEnroe and Borg as the James Dean of rivalries. They play 14 times. Federer and Djokovic have played a million times. Okay, they've played far more than Rafa and Fed have played. But the line I keep using about them, and I think you agree with it, is there was a Magic and Bird quality to Fed and Rafa. And I love the fact after the Wawrinka match, when he said that they had gotten together and his knee is still rehabbing and Rafa's rehabbing his wrist. And he said, well, maybe we could play a charity event sometime, just one last hurrah. And Rafa's saying, that sounds like that'd be kind of fun. And now, of course, here we are one match away but there was a magic about this. And I'm not saying it was Borg and McEnroe, but you know what? It's pretty damn close to Borg and McEnroe, which was there.
Great. And again, it's the lefty-righty thing. It's the fact that Rafa grinds from the baseline and Roger uses the whole court. When Roger plays Novak Djokovic, they both play exactly the style they want to play. I happen to love that matchup because they both do what they do best against each other. Roger is not allowed to do what he does best against Rafa because of the weight of Rafa's shots, the high-kicking lefty stuff into his backhand. He actually has to try to figure out a way to play through that. And again, it goes back to matchups and what's so great about them. The Rafa-Roger matchup, the fact that they've been at it for so long and they both care so much still, it's a great rivalry. Christy and Martina had that lefty-righty. One of them wants to come in and use the whole court. One of them wants to stay in the baseline and try to pass. What's better than that? Not much. I'm very happy, I have to tell you, and it's not a knock against either one of them, but Novak Djokovic and Andy Murray have played in these finals. Andy Murray has lost 5 Australian Open finals, 4 of them to Novak, 1 to Roger. I hate watching that. I don't hate watching that match. Of course, I'll watch that match, but they play so similarly that it tends to be a long slog of a match, and then invariably, at this tournament anyway, Andy would get aggravated and kind of go away after a while. Some matchups are just much more aesthetically and tactically pleasing than others. And to your point, that's why I think Federer and Nadal have had a magical rivalry in the way that, in the way that I love watching Monica Seles play Steffi Graf. I love watching Martina play Chrissy. You know, some of them are just, some of them are, it's just beautiful.
They're extremely organic, too. You can't plan for them. There's no timetable for them in golf. What did golf need? Somebody like Tiger Woods, except golf didn't know it needed somebody like Tiger Woods until Tiger Woods came along. And by the way, I think you'll agree with me. I think you'll agree with me about Andy Murray. Mayor, if you lose five finals at a Grand Slam, I just think that's enough. You don't get to go back. I just think that they just say,
I love Sir Andy. He was knighted at the end of last year. Although a lot of times he's Surly Andy, but that's okay. Again, he is a guy who's the ultimate. He can get very cranky. I mean, he's a Mr. Cranky Pants out there an awful lot. Yeah. But off the court, he is as thoughtful and smart and professional about what he's trying to do than anybody. I'm a big fan of Sir Andy. I really am.
No, I'm only kidding.
I like these players. You know, don't break his little heart. I mean, he's trying his hardest, but boy, did he lose here early.
Oh, boy. And
This tournament has been amazing. Can I just tell you something? On the first day of this tournament, in the first couple of hours, Simona Halep lost, and I thought, wow, this is a big deal. By the end of the day, I had forgotten that she lost because so many other things have happened at this tournament, Michael. Old players, young players, ingenues, big upsets, great surprises. This has been one of those, the storylines in this particular major have been, I cannot remember a major that had so many storylines on both men's and women's, you know, on in both draws.
Yeah.
It's been great.
By the way, on Andy Murray, I was being stupidly flippant because there's one thing that always, there's two things that make me root for Andy Murray, and I do root for him even when he is being Mr. Cranky Pants. One is he is a child of gun violence and a child of Dunblane and a reference point, okay? Because he's a kid who survived a school shooting by being in the right place as opposed to the wrong place. And he shows you what the world would have lost if he had been in the wrong place. That's one thing. And the other thing is, It's a little like when Connors came back and was number one in the world in 1982. One guy thought he could be number one again. Jimmy did. And Andy Murray threw Federer and Nadal and Djokovic in his heart. He felt if he kept working, he might be number one in the world. And then he got to number one. So it's worth rooting for. All right, let's go to the Williams sisters.
This takes us to Venus. I mean, this is the ultimate look at the whole idea of you can lose, but don't quit. You know, it's what Andy Murray has done, and it's what Venus Williams has done. Venus Williams is, in a couple of months, she's 37 years old, you know, and she gets Sjogren's syndrome in 2011 at the U.S. Open. She tells us that she's been diagnosed with this thing, which is just depletes all your energy, and you've got to change your diet and all of that. So I think for a lot of us, we figured, all right, well, you know, she'll never really be a big part of the conversation again. And of course, here she is now, got back to the top 10 a couple of years ago, and now she's in the championship match against her sister.
You know, we had a thing in football. Merritt, we had a thing in football where in back-to-back Super Bowls, two brothers were Super Bowl MVPs and their team won. Okay? And so I have often said to people, what are we more likely to see again? We're more likely to see that again than to see what the Williams sisters have done in their sport over the last 2 years, individually, with each other, and even against each other.
Tell me a sports story that's the equal of that when you think about it.
There is not one. It's.
I'm not sure there is. And I'm not sure it gets the credit, only because Venus has not, obviously, Venus has won seven major titles. Serena is now trying to win her 23rd, so that great rivalry between them went away in large measure, and Serena has obviously lapped everybody in modern times with how many majors she's won. But still, Michael, you know, they continue to win. They won Wimbledon doubles together last summer, for God's sake. I mean, it's extraordinary to me what they're like.
Where did they come from? Where did they end up? It's one of the most remarkable. It's not just an American sports story. It's a remarkable American story. It's got elements of Jackie Robinson. It's got elements of Althea Gibson. It's got elements of Arthur Ashe. But even that's too limiting because I'm only referencing African Americans. It's an extraordinary story about the possibilities of our country, which, by the way, Mary, I think we both are in agreement. We hope they continue. Don't you think so, Mary?
How's it going? How's America doing these days, by the way? I'm thinking hard about hanging out in Australia for a little while longer.
Yeah, I was watching you do that piece of the zoo the other night on the Tennis Channel. I'm thinking, you know, she looks happy there with the penguins and the marsupials.
I'm very happy here, Michael. It's an affirming place. It really is.
While we're on the verge of a collective nervous breakdown in this country, and because, you know, remember, it wasn't long ago that who's going to pay for the wall? Mexico is. We didn't know that the fine print was that it was going to be on a layaway plan. You know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Isn't this why we love sports? Because it's all about resilience. And we have seen it. Everyone we've talked about so far in this conversation, we've talked about people who have the courage and the guts to reset. You know, these are people who have bigger engines than the rest of us. And that is why we can be so amazed and amused and inspired by them.
And by the way, Mary, this thing with voter fraud with the new president, it would be like, let's say that, Mary, it would be like if Federer and Nadal play one more epic five-set match, okay? And say Federer wins, okay? But at his post-match press conference, he said, you know, there were like five calls that I got that were like totally wrong. And I really think that we have to go back and look at some of those calls because the outcome could have been different. And here's the other thing with Trump. Whoever heard of a winner contesting the results?
Yeah, honestly, Michael, I have tried so hard and I've been largely successful in just being, just wrapping my arms around this remarkable 2-week tennis tournament. Every now and then I'll look at news I feel like one of those seafaring travelers who finally, you know, docks into port again and says, you know, to the innkeeper, what news of the outside world? You know, like that's kind of how I've been behaving for these last couple of weeks. It seems easier on me to, you know, to go that route these days.
We are talking to Mary Carrillo on the Mike Lupica podcast, who has written an extraordinary career for her in news and broadcasting and features in the Olympics and even throwing down shots of vodka with Bob Costas at the Olympics one time. Mary, let's just focus on Serena for 1 second, because, you know, obviously we have expanded the conversation about her and extended it far outside of sports. This is one of the great sports champions in the history of our country.
Yes, she is. And she, honestly, after the way she loses in the semifinal of the U.S. Open, gets outplayed by Karolina Pliskova, who's a very talented young Czech. Yep. And then she decides, as she did last year, to just shut down the rest of her season. And I'm wondering, all right, is she working hard or is she just kind of airing out? Like, what is she doing with this time? And how is she disinclined to get back on the road and to keep trying? I mean, she's already had this breathtaking career, 22 minutes. Is she going to come back in a big way? And frankly, Michael, she played a pre-Australian Open, a warm-up tournament. She looked terrible. She lost to someone named Madison Brengel and made 88 errors in a 2-out-of-3 set match. And I'm thinking, man, oh, man, I guess she hasn't been doing much in the off season. You know, normally people take that training block very seriously and show up fresh. And then she comes here. She had one bad match. She lost her serve a couple of times a few rounds ago to another Czech player, Barbara Strýcová. But the way she's got this great ability to, when she's not playing well, she's tense. And then she goes from tense to intense. And it is really one of the most remarkable things you've ever seen. You know, Serena likes to say, I never choke. That's not true. Everyone chokes. But No, but when Serena gets tight and falls back down, she has this astonishing ability to play well when she's tight. And then once she gets past that, and she'll have some important break of serve to get herself back into that set, then she's off again. And she goes from tense to intense. And I've never seen anybody on the court show it so viscerally. You know, show in the way she snarls and walks and throws her fist in the air. And there's just so much coming out of her. It's just one of the, I love watching that. It's really kind of rapturous to see her when she's in that state. And again, the fact that she's got to have to bring that to her older sister to win this championship and get past Steffi Graf's record. I don't even know how you... How can that not be fraught? And yet she's so competitive that I have a feeling she's gonna be able to do it against Venus and win this title again.
Mary, even if Nadal makes the final, there will be 60. It's just a ridiculous thing what's happened in this sport. There will be 60 major championships. That's 60 major championships in both finals. There are already 46 majors in the finals without Nadal. Okay. If it is Federer in Nadal, there will be 31 on the court. If Venus and Serena, there's 29. And then you factor in Murray, and then you factor in Djokovic. And which Djokovic got 12 and was on his way to thinking he was going to be the GOAT. Okay.
Yeah.
It's why when people look at me and say, why do you care so much about this sport? I said, because we're living, I don't know if the other sports think they're in a golden age right now. We're in the golden age of tennis. And every time when you think, oh, okay, all these young guys are going to come along. Here comes the old guys to act like headbangers. But this is these last.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll throw Pete and Andre in there. Okay, the last 25 years in tennis, men's and women's. Okay, even with what's happened to American tennis since Pete and Andre, has been one of the extraordinary golden ages in history.
I know, and I mean, there's part of me that worries what's going to happen when they go away. You know, what happens when Serena doesn't want to play anymore, or Rafa, or Roger, you know? But I got to tell you, it seems to me like they all want to hang around. These are remarkable champions that don't seem to burn out, that don't seem to sell out. They want to hang around. Roger Federer loves being Roger Federer, Michael. I've never seen anyone who enjoys being who he is more than Roger Federer.
Arnold Palmer
Arnold Palmer, is Arnold the guy?
Arnold loved being Arnold Palmer. He was born to play one part, Arnold Palmer. And you're 100% right. Roger was born to play the part he's playing. And Mary, what you just said, you know, people ought to think about that. Brady's talking about playing quarterback till he's 45. Okay, when Roger's 55, Mayor, when Roger's 55, nobody's going to say, "Hey, you still want to play?" So I would play until I'm just done, like done.
Exactly. Well, Michael, what is that great Billie Jean King quote about Jimmy Connors? Didn't Billie Jean tell you something about him?
Yeah, I was just telling this story to by the way, Mary, you go ahead, Miss Snarky Pants, with my latest tennis pro, because Mary says that I go through tennis pros like Madison Keys, but I was telling this story the other day. I had not been in, when I was a kid, I started going to Wimbledon with Bud Collins, the great, late, great Bud Collins. And so I saw Borg and McEnroe, and I saw McEnroe and Connors, and I saw all that stuff. I saw Arthur Wynn. And then I had stayed away for about 5 years, not by any decision. It's just the way my career, my life went. I go back in 87, and Connors is playing Michael Pernfors in the round of 16 on center court, and he's losing 6-1, 6-1, 4-1. Let me do the math for people. He's lost 16 out of the first 19 games of this match, okay? And now I wasn't even going to write that down. I'd say, now I got to stay because I will write Jimmy's tennis eulogy, okay? And then he gets a hold and a break, and I turned to a guy in the press box, and I said, he's the only guy who thinks he's got Pernfors right where he wants him now. Okay, and we'd see this later in 91 with Patrick Matthew. He comes back and wins the match. Okay, I'm waiting for him outside the locker room after, as I run into Billie Jean King, and she said, let me tell you something. Borg is going to wake up when he's 50 years old in the middle of the night and say, what if? She said, I love John McEnroe, but he's going to wake up when he's 50 years old in the middle of the night and say, what if? And she points up to where Jimmy is in the locker room. He said, he's never going to ask those questions. And boy, if I'm an athlete, you're right. Fed's never going to ask those questions. Nadal's never going to ask those questions. I hope Djokovic never has to ask those questions, because you're right. It's good being king. You know, these guys like being king.
No kidding. And Michael, as someone who gets to watch these people play, it is an uncommon privilege to be around the sport in the time that you and I have been around it. I mean, we have seen some remarkable athletes doing astonishing things.
Have we missed anything today?
Oh, that's, you know, we can go on forever. But no, those, I think we hit the big stuff.
I'm extremely jealous that you have had a front row seat to this. It is always, particularly with tennis, but on pretty much any subject, it's a privilege to talk to you. You know that in your career, not enough good things can continue to happen. And guess what? After everything we've talked about today, there's still more tennis to be played in Melbourne. Thank you, Mary.
My pleasure, Michael. Anytime.
Mary Carrillo, not just the best tennis broadcaster on the planet, just one of the great broadcasters on the planet. This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Please, this is the kind of conversation we have every single week. Please continue to subscribe, download it. If you want to go to the comment section, you can. It you won't hurt my feelings. You can say mean things. God gives the heaviest burdens to the strongest backs. And we will talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lupica Podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica Podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica Podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.